Good morning. My name is John Gross with Hydronic Specialties and JTG Muir. Today we have Brian Cummings with the Western Regional Manager for Hubbell Water Heaters. And he's going to do an overview of Hubbell. And if you have any questions, what I'd like you to do is to save them and put them in a form of a chat so that we can address them near the end of the presentation. This will allow Brian to complete his presentation. Take it from here, Brian.
Great. Thank you, John. So, as John said, I'm the Western Regional Manager for Hubbell Water Heaters. I'm based out of Denver, Colorado, and, travel around, present this presentation all kinds of places. So, when this whole thing is over, if you'd like me to come into your office and give a presentation more in depth on any particular item or whatever, just talk with John and we can arrange that as well. There it goes. Didn't want to change the slide there. So this is a brief outline of the presentation. I'm going to talk a little bit about Hubbell and give you an overview of what our products are. The main things that we're going to talk about, though, are some different materials and linings that are available for tanks out there and why there are different materials, different linings, why things are done differently by us versus other companies and stuff. And then we're going to talk about some new ways of applying water heaters out there and in California with some of your initiatives with getting rid of greenhouse gases generation on site. Electric water heaters are kind of becoming a thing again as well, and that's kind of our strength. So just a brief overview of Hubbell. We were founded in 1920, so we're 100 years old this year, as the electric heater company. And the company was purchased by Harvey Hubbell in 1926, who is known for making all kinds of different electrical innovations. They're still in business, Hubbell, but they're a different company than we are. They do electrical stuff, and they're just down the street in Connecticut from where our main office is located. The company was taken private again in 1931 and been family owned since then. The main thing that we have to offer that differentiates our product is something called Hydrostone lining, which I'll explain here shortly. And that was invented by Hubbell in 1962. A couple other facts about the company. Everything that we make is made in the USA. It's Buy American, Buy America Act compliant. We have three manufacturing facilities in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and in California. Corona is where it is in California. And each one focuses on different things and different types of heaters. Everything that we do is focused upon commercial water heating needs. So we do some residential, but instead of like many manufacturers that take the residential and upscale it for commercial, we're kind of taking commercial stuff and downscaling it for residential. So that's really our strength here is the commercial side of things. In terms of the products that we offer, we have a pretty full line of water heaters. There are a lot of specialty applications that we cover. For inputs between electric, gas, steam, indirect, heat pumps, and storage tanks are kind of the main ones that we have. We have a wide range within each of those. We do storage, we can do instantaneous, we can do point-of-use type heaters. And some of the things that we're really specialized in are niche market, smaller things that you may come across. For instance, pure water applications in hospitals, things like that, explosion-resistant heaters, circulation type heaters, booster heaters for dishwashers, food service, that sort of thing. We can build you custom skids for whatever your water heating needs, do emergency showers with a particular type of water heater. I'll get into the details on that one a little bit later. And we can build vertical and horizontal tanks between 1,000 and 5,000 gallons. And also we can make them from different materials. And that's where I'd like to start the presentation here, is just talking about the different materials that are out there for water heaters and why they're used and why it's important to understand what the differences are between them. So the first thing to understand is the mechanism of corrosion in water heaters. The reason that we don't use a bare steel tank is because it'll just rust away. And it happens fairly quickly in water environments. Water is very corrosive. In fact, it to some level will absorb just about every substance on Earth. And that's why we have to make the construction of the tanks. It's very specific for the different applications and stuff that are out there. So the means that the corrosion occurs in a water heater is something called galvanic corrosion. And generally it's associated when you have two different metals that are in contact with each other, an electrolyte, which in this case is the water, because it can conduct electricity between the two different materials. What happens is one of them becomes more cathodic and one of them becomes more anodic, which essentially means one of them has extra electrons and the other one wants to take them away from it. So what you get is a current that flows between the anode and the cathode. It's stripping electrons from one material. And the example that's shown here, you have brass and steel. And so the brass is more noble, we'd say. So it wants to strip the electrons from the steel. So now, for the corrosion to actually happen, two things have to happen. So first, we have to have the stripping of the electron, or actually an iron is two electrons. And then we have to have oxygen present at that surface to form the iron oxide, that is the rust. Now, when we deal with water heaters, it's a little bit different. We still have our steel, if we have a bare steel tank in this example, which is your anode, and the water is both the electrolyte and the cathode. So the water is what's sucking the electrons out of the steel itself. So it's the same basic mechanism. You first have to strip the electron, and then there's always oxygen present in water in open loop systems, in this potable water. When you get into closed loop systems and you can use things like cast iron pumps, the reason that you can is because it's closed loop. There isn't continuous oxygen supply in there that's renewed. Every time in a water heater or in a hot water system, you draw water out and put it in the building, you're adding oxygenated water back into that tank. So you're going to have oxygen present at all times. All right. So just looking at the galvanic corrosion, there's a couple things that drive it faster. So one of them is higher impurities. If you have pure water, truly pure water, it actually isn't conductive and this won't happen. There's other mechanisms that happen in pure water applications that cause corrosion. But as you drive the impurities up, as your water gets harder, in particular, as you're driven closer to coastal regions where you have chlorides in the water, the impurity level goes up. And when that happens, the galvanic corrosion rate goes up. Essentially, the resistance of the water drops. And that allows that current to flow faster, which means the electrons can be stripped more quickly from the steel. As you go up in temperature, this happens more quickly too, as with many chemical reactions. So a rule of thumb that I was told years ago is that when you go from 120 degrees to 140 degree water temperature, that doubles the rate of reaction. And that means that we really need to look at commercial differently than residential. What works in residential applications might not be heavy duty enough for commercial applications, and in fact, isn't in most cases. Also, as you use more water, this rate goes up. The water only strips so many electrons, and when it's satisfied, it will stop doing that. So in your house, when you take a shower in the morning, the water is going to pull so many electrons in, and it can only rust so much until that tank is drained again. When you have commercial applications where there's constant water draws on the tank, that means that the water is always hungry for these electrons and will continue to pull them. And then another factor is the surface area of the tank. The larger the tank volume, larger the tank, the faster that this will occur. And that's a function of the galvanic corrosion itself. So now the question is, how do we stop this from happening? So there's a couple things that we can do. The simplest one is to electrically isolate the materials. And so for instance, in a dielectric union, you have these two insulators between the two different materials. And that's a very good way of doing it. And again, it's an electrical phenomenon that's occurring here. There's actually a current that's flowing. The electrons are flowing between the two materials. And by creating an electric insulator, you stop the reaction from occurring. You have two different materials that are pretty close proximity. Another thing that's commonly used is an anode rod, and I'll explain exactly what that is in a minute. And then the other thing you do is choose a different material. What I've shown here is, the steel is the one giving up the electrons. And essentially, depending on the material that you choose, it can either be balanced with the water or it can pull the electrons from the water And the material that pulls the electrons away doesn't corrode. It's the one that loses the electrons that does. The most common type of water heater is based around a glass-lined storage tank. And the glass is a lining which is added to the interior of the tank, generally after the fittings and everything is welded, and then it's baked at a high temperature to melt this glass. And it's about 5/1000ths of an inch thick, so it's about the thickness of a piece of paper. It covers most surfaces on the inside of the tank. Now, what they'd end up doing is around the fittings, they'll mask it so that the weld does not crack away the glass. Or if they don't mask it, when they weld, the glass cracks away and you have this open material. So the manufacturers know this. They know that it doesn't cover all the surface of the tank and that it leaves metal exposed and there's defects in the process and stuff like that. So instead of trying to make sure the coating coats everything or make a coat better, what they do is they put it on an anode rod. So the anode rod is made out of magnesium, which wants to corrode more quickly than the steel does. So that means when you put fresh water in the tank, it's hungry for the electrons, it's going to pull them from the magnesium preferentially to the steel. It doesn't stop the corrosion of the steel, it just slows it down. Now what happens is, of course, over time, the anode rod rusts away, removing the material from the anode rod and adding it to the water. Magnesium 2+ is what's added to it. So you get a little bit higher magnesium contents, which isn't bad for you because there's naturally magnesium in the water. But these need service over time. And I'm sure as you guys know, the maintenance guys and stuff are really on top of this. And they're going to check the anode rods every 6 months and replace them as required. Of course, that doesn't happen. In fact, I was talking to one of my reps who also reps some glass line tanks. And he says he's never sold an anode rod in the 15 years that he's been doing this. So it just isn't maintained. What happens is the anode rod depletes, such as the one in the bottom of the picture, and then you rust the steel. So it's not an actual protection for it, it just delays the process from happening. The most common thing that we have in our tanks is something called a hydrostone lining. And so it's a cement lining. And unlike the glass lining in tanks, it's quite thick, it's 1/2 inch thick. It's also applied after all the fittings and everything is welded in place in the tank, so it covers all surfaces of the metal. There is not one little bit of bare metal within the cement lined tank. On regular glass lined tanks, all the fittings are going to be mild steel as well. They have to be, because if you put a stainless steel fitting in there, you'd have another dielectric connection and it would rust at that point. Because we cover everything up, we also use 304 stainless fittings or various other materials. And that means you don't have rusting which occurs at fittings either. So that's gonna last longer. We do not have an anode rod in these type of tanks. Again, there are no bare surfaces. We use a proprietary process in the majority of our tanks where it's spun. So the cement is added to the tank, it's put up on a rig, it's spun, and it deposits the lining evenly over all surfaces of the tank and forms this barrier. So we're certain that there isn't exposed steel with the process that we have. With this, now the water quality itself doesn't matter. The rate of reaction is essentially zero because there's no exposed steel in these tanks. And so therefore they're usable in a much wider range of water qualities than a glass lined tank, and they're gonna last much longer because of that. As I mentioned earlier, we invented this process over 60 years ago, and we've developed it and improved it over time to ensure that the tanks last and perform over a very long time. The downside to this, as opposed to a glass lined tank, is you have 1/2 inch of cement. It makes for a heavier tank. Now, a couple things about that. First of all, these are going on commercial sites. The tank's heavy. Usually you can rig it and it's not a big deal to get it in place. A glass lined tank by itself is still very heavy. And secondly, once you fill the tank up with water, there isn't that much of a difference in the weight of the tanks between a glass line and a cement line. It's the water which weighs much higher. So they're within 5% of each other once they're filled with water. So there isn't a whole lot which has to be done structurally to prevent this from falling through or whatever, different from a glass line tank. So it's a consideration sometimes if you have to get into a hard site to access or something like that, but you know, in general, it's not that big of a deal with it. So stainless steel is another material which is commonly used for tanks. And when talking about corrosion of stainless steel, a couple things. So first of all, stainless steel, people say, oh, it doesn't rust. Well, actually, stainless steel does rust. It rusts very quickly. And if you cut it, the outer surface will be actual stainless steel for a brief period of time, and then it corrodes with the oxygen in the air. And it forms a layer that's called an oxide layer. The difference is if you take regular steel and you add oxygen to the outer layer of atoms, it swells. So you add the oxygen, it pushes the layer out. And when it does that, it exposes another layer of atoms underneath, which oxygen can then go in and corrode. And that's what happens. That's why you see this flaking nature of regular steel, regular iron oxide on steel. The stainless steel, when it absorbs the atoms, that surface layer does not grow. It stays the same size. So therefore, it stays in place and is actually an advantage. And that's a lot of the reason why stainless steels are very good at preventing further corrosion, because that layer is there. It's already reacting with something, so it doesn't want to react with anything more. If we create this layer, it's referred to as passivizing the steel, or passivization. Some steels will self-passivate, meaning that if you scratch them, it will form this oxide layer again very quickly. And other types of steels require a dip in an acid bath or a spray in order to form this layer. So if there is damage to the surface or whatever, in the manufacturing process, it can rust from that point. It's a different type of corrosion mechanism which occurs, but it is possible. When we talk about stainless steel, we have to break it into two categories. We have austenitic stainless steels, which are the most common, 304 and 316. And then we also have duplex stainless steels, which are going to start with a 21. So 2101 through 2107 are commonly what's used for water heaters. Now, in most applications, stainless steel is going to provide excellent corrosion resistance and a very long water heater life. But there are some things to consider with these tanks. They are not perfect by any means. And in some environments, they can corrode very quickly, actually. With the austenitic stainless steel tanks, the thing to worry about is something called chloride stress cracking. So you get chlorides, which is a chlorine atom with a negative charge, or you get chlorine, which is Cl2, in enough concentration. You have stresses in the tank from the water pressure, from the welds, from the cold working when we roll the cylindrical part of the tank. There are stresses which are created in doing that. And then the third thing that's required is austenitic stainless steels are prone to this issue. And so what it is it's intergranular cracking. So it forms very small cracks between the small grains of the material. And this can happen very quickly. These cracks will form through the material and then the tanks will kind of seep. And if you were to hit it with a hammer, it's very, it becomes very fragile, like an eggshell, not like you'd expect a stainless steel tank to be. So this is something you have to watch out for. There are certain areas of the U.S. where people won't ship, or I should say most manufacturers won't ship stainless steel tanks because they corrode very quickly in those conditions. Excuse me. So what we've done is stainless steel has a lot of positive things about it. So we've gone in and investigated this further. And we've come up with some means to get around this type of cracking. So we had issues in our products about 20 years ago. And what we found to be common with them is that it occurs around the welds of the tank. So the highest stresses, if you look at the picture to the right, are in these colored zones called the heat affected zone around the weld. And we went in and developed a process to heat treat these vessels after they've been welding to relieve these stresses, the annealing process. Okay. So by doing this, we reduce the stresses in these areas to essentially zero. And then it's, you don't have enough stress from just the pressure of the water pushing out of the vessel to create this issue. So we can use these tanks in pretty much any application, as opposed to, again, other manufacturers who say, oh, you have to have below 50 ppm chlorides or something in order to use this tank and have the warranty on it. We will put these in different applications. Something else we'll do with them is if you get to very pure water applications, you want 316 stainless steel. We can also electropolish the tanks, which will eliminate another form of failure that can occur due to pure waters. So our tanks are much more, have much higher resistance to chloride stress cracking than other stainless steel tanks that are out on the market there. So the other type, we don't make this type, but they're starting to become much more common. I believe that there's 3 or 4 manufacturers now in the US that are making these, called duplex stainless steel in the 2100 series. And so the advantage of duplex is it is not affected by chloride stress cracking. Duplex is one of those materials that must be properly passivized in manufacturing, or it will corrode very quickly within the environment. So it is that oxide layer on the surface that's really important in applying these tanks. The duplex is the opposite of the 316 stainless, where you don't want to put it in applications where the water is very pure. And it, again, it's the picture on the lower right there has a picture of the intergranular cracking. So it's similar to chloride stress cracking, but it has to do with very pure water applications. So you want to make sure there's some impurities in the water that's drinking water, that it's not a hospital or something like that. And the other downside of these tanks is they're very expensive. Duplex is very difficult to work with compared to other types of stainless steel or mild steel. And so the tanks are consequently more expensive. All right. The last material that you'll see tanks manufactured out of, and this is one of our specialties, is a material called Cooper Nickel. So Cooper Nickel is kind of the ultimate in corrosion resistance around potable water applications. And it will not corrode in any, if you can drink the water, you're not going to have corrosion with this, is usually what I say. So there's a couple things that it does to prevent all different types of corrosion. We focused on one here, but there are many different types of corrosion which can occur in water heaters and stuff as well. Again, the pure water corrosion is different than what I've spoken about here, but some of the things that we've talked about will prevent that from happening as well. So one of the key things that happens when you add a little bit of nickel to copper is it changes the electron configuration of copper. So going way back to chemistry class, if you remember the far right column on the periodic table is something called the noble gases, and they won't react with anything because they have 8 electrons in their outer shell, which is kind of a magic number when it comes to balance. And so copper normally has 9, which isn't a bad thing, but when you add a little bit of nickel to it, it goes down to 8. So it doesn't want to react with anything because of that. It also has something called a electronegativity, which is very high. So a nonstick pan, for instance, is something that with a high electronegativity. And in fact, some nonstick pans are now made out of Cooper Nickel because people think that the coatings that have been used in the past, they're fluorine-based, are unhealthy for you. So you're starting to see that as another application for a Cooper Nickel in the marketplace. But things won't bond to it. So you can't get things like bacterial growth on the surface of the tank and things like that that can then cause additional corrosion issues and stuff that you can with other materials. It's not susceptible to the galvanic corrosion in water. What happens is it strips the electrons from the water rather than the other way around. So it's not going to corrode in that means. And it also has a protective oxide layer that forms naturally. So it's very good. It's not going to corrode. It's going to last forever in potable water applications. The downside, of course, is that the cost is much higher. Copper is very expensive compared to steel. So, and in addition, it doesn't have the tensile strength that you get with steel. So the walls are thicker on these tanks and consequently a higher cost. Majority of these that we make go to the Navy. and they use the material because they want really long life, and they're also in the on the very bottoms of ships, and they're exposed to salt water on the outside of the tanks as well, in the bilge. So all those things make it an ideal material for that particular application. Now, different materials, how do you know what to choose? And the answer is, it's very difficult. If you go to different municipalities and you ask them what's their water quality, they're going to give you a document they're required to by the EPA that shows different concentrations of chemicals and things in the water. And they're going to show that and say, oh yeah, we have very clean water. Well, that's at the water treatment facility. It's going to flow through a lot of pipes. It's going to pick up all kinds of different impurities. By the time it gets to your house or wherever it's being used, the water is going to be very different than what it was. So with the higher impurities, you're going to get higher rates of corrosion. And about the only measure that we have to look across the United States is something called water hardness. Now, this tracks only two things. It tracks magnesium and calcium concentrations in the water. Generally, chlorides go with that, but there are certain areas, for instance, in Tennessee and Mississippi down there, Alabama, where there are high levels of chlorides without high levels of magnesium and calcium in the water. And that's an area that a lot of stainless steel tanks will struggle in. So this isn't the best measurement, but this is kind of what we have to work with through different areas. And there's a lot of factors, a lot of different things in water that cause corrosion. So kind of as a summary of this section, look, as you go with different materials, the cost of the tank goes up, of course. So the cheapest tanks are glass-lined tanks, and they're going to work in the least range of water hardness for their maximum tank life if you maintain that anode rod in them. And that's, you know, an assumption which isn't made. Generally, they're replaced every three to five years, and that's kind of what you get out of them in commercial applications. So moving up the scale, Hydrostone is a bit more expensive than glass, about 30%, I'd say, and it's going to provide you with a much wider range. Again, the water quality really doesn't matter so much because it's not in contact with the steel of the tank. And then we have our two stainless, 304, 316. They're going to be more expensive. The difference between the two of them is that 316 is what's used for pure water applications. So a little bit more expensive than 304. So, you know, in most applications, if it's not pure water, 304 is going to work good. Duplex, again, you don't want the very pure water with it. You want to make sure that it's has some impurities into it to prevent rusting. And then lastly, the most expensive is going to be Cooper Nickel. And it's going to cover anything that you can drink out there pretty much. So that's why there's different materials and just some insight into why you might want to look at different materials than particular applications and stuff. And generally, like I say, our most popular product is Hydrostone because it is a little bit more expensive than glass, but it's going to provide a lot longer life. We had a study down on the East Coast where they have some very poor water quality. And in New York City, they found that we last anywhere between 28 and 32 years on average for a water heater as compared to a glass line, which is 3 to 5 years. So, you know, it's a very good material for that, and kind of a compromise between the higher priced alternatives and the lower priced glass line tanks. All right. So now we'll move on to applications here. And I'm going to take a quick second to have a drink here. All right. So we're seeing some changes in the water heating market now. And a couple reasons for this. So, you know, years ago they came out with the condensing gas-fired water heaters. And those are what everybody wanted to have because they brought your efficiency from 80% up into the 90%. And now we're seeing gas is kind of topping out at that close to 99%, 90, 95 to 99% range, we'll say. And you can't get any more efficiency out of the water heater. An electric has been a good choice because it's always been 99% efficient. You know, the heat is all produced at the electrical coil. And we can't get much more efficiency out of that. We're also seeing a change in codes, mainly due to Legionella. And what's being discovered is it used to be, oh, you need 140 degree water for 1 minute or 10 minutes or whatever. There's all kinds of different things out there for it. And it's going to kill all the bacteria in that water. And what's being discovered is that really isn't the case. You need higher water temperatures or prolonged exposure to it. And that leads to the VA hospital code, which now they're looking at storing at 160 degrees and recirc loops at 140 and then having mixing valves distributed throughout the building. And so the hospital code is going to follow the VA code here shortly. And then with that, the rest of the codes will probably follow residential codes and stuff to these higher temperatures. So given this constraint, how do we increase the efficiency of our hot water systems? The answer is we need to look beyond just the water heater. We need to look at the whole system. If we look at a typical system, you have your tank in the basement, water heater, you store with your storage tank, goes through a mixing valve out to all the different branches, and then it comes back through a recirculation loop. A study by NREL a number of years ago looked at recirculation losses in hospitals. Up to 40% of the energy goes out through the recirculation loop. Apartments, it's almost half, 46%. In offices, because that loop is running 24/7, it's up to 3/4 of the losses in that building are through that loop. And just as a note, if it does go up to 140 degrees, that's a 30% increase in your losses from the recirc loop. So that's what we're seeing now, is that the recirculation losses are really driving the losses in the system. So we need to look at ways to improve this portion of the system rather than the efficiency of the overall hot water heater. And well, one of the things that we can help you with is something called application-targeted heating. And instead of having one water heater in the basement with the losses that are associated with it, we want to shorten that recirculation loop in order to decrease the losses there. And the way that we can do that is by having several smaller water heaters throughout the building, point of use things and stuff like that. And this is a place where electrical really comes into play. You don't have any venting. Gas water heaters, again, you have to put vents to the outside in many different places, and it can get to be expensive. We do smaller storage or instantaneous type heaters with it very easily. And the idea is that overall it's going to provide a cost savings and a long-term cost savings for the building rather than having to continually power this recirculation. So just a couple ideas with some of the products that we offer for this. Point of use water heaters. Where these guys would be used is if you have a bathroom that's kind of a long ways away from recirculation, something without a shower. You know, in most buildings, you aren't going to get rid of a centralized water heater with that recirc loop. You can, it would just take a lot more electricity because your diversity factor goes down. But these type of water heaters are designed to run, the one on the upper right would run a sink. So each sink would have a little 1 gallon storage tank. And then it has a 450 watt element in it that you can plug into 120 volts. So there isn't even special electrical needs that are required for it. And 1 gallon for hand washing is more than enough. You're never going to deplete that tank in that application. The next one over on the bottom there is one which has 6 gallons of storage, and we can go with larger elements in it just because it's a bit larger tank. And that could do like a men and women's bathroom, you know, a long ways away from the central plant, and have its own little recirculation loop back to the heater to cover that. We can also have ones that mount on the ceiling. And in California, this of course is something to consider with your earthquakes and stuff. We do have specialized mounts on the tanks that can allow them to mount and be secure even in earthquake zones. You make those in 30 and 40 gallons. And again, they can handle several bathrooms, maybe with a shower, something like that, where you're not having to run this recirc line out. You just have to run power up to these guys. We also have a full line of instantaneous electric from 3 kilowatts up to 162 kilowatts. And then we have another line which goes above and beyond that. So these are very good units, in particular if you're used to the gas ones. They have advantages over them. So they require no venting. The modulation is basically from 0 to 100%. They need to have some flow across them in order to activate the unit. 0.3 gallons per minute is all, but once you reach that, it can modulate wherever it needs to in there. These things are quite small, easy to install, and the wire is pretty easy to run these units throughout the building. The efficiency, again, is going to be about 99% with these units. The downside is they require quite a bit of power. So if you want to get an 80-degree rise, you need 12 kilowatts per GPM in order to do that. And the electrical infrastructure can get quite large in order to power that. So let's have a look here. This would be a competitor's unit. This would be the majority of what you see on the market. A couple things to note. These have a plastic chamber on them. So instead of having a metal chamber, it's all plastic. It's meant to be very inexpensive. The way that these work is there's a flow switch which activates flow and a temperature switch which activates when the temperature is reached. And you have this large contactor on the side. So you open up your faucet, the water starts flowing through the unit, comes through, gets heated up, it comes out the other side, and everything's fine if that flow rate is exactly what this unit was designed for. What happens is if it's the flow rate is less than its design rate is that the temperature switch will have to switch off and the contact will have to switch off. So what you get is this kind of click, 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 click as that contactor switches on and off. You're not going to get very good temperature control because the idea of an instantaneous heater is that there's not a lot of volume in there. It's heated all at once. So as that element powers up and off, it's going to be difficult for it to control the temperature to its set point as you'd want it to. The Hubble units are quite a bit different than these. So this unit that's shown here has three chambers, it's for three phase, but we also make two phase 240 volt heaters as well. And this one here has a flow meter on it. So when the cold water comes in, it goes through the flow meter. There's a thermistor on the inlet to measure the temperature. So now you know how much water you're flowing, you know what its temperature is, and you know exactly how much power you have to put into the water in order to hit your desired temperature. On top of it, there's an outlet thermistor which just monitors the outlet temperature and makes small trimming adjustments to the power output to the unit. Now we have a contactor in there, and the only reason that contactor would be used is if there's an over temperature condition. So it's not used to control the power to the elements. It's just used to kick them off in the case of an over temperature event. So we can do this continuous variation in the power, and you're going to get consistent water temperature. The other thing is the other units are designed for one fixture only. So if you have a one GPM fixture, you have to put one unit on that fixture. Because we can handle the different flow rates, these units can handle multiple different fixtures. So that can simplify plumbing for bathrooms or whatever you have. And as the fixtures come on, this unit will adjust very quickly to the changes. Another key difference is the type of heating element that's used. So the less expensive units also have something called an open heating coil. And if you look at it, the portion of the coil which does the work is exposed to the water. And this is going to corrode, there's going to be scale which builds up on it, causing hot spots, and they can fail quite quickly. If you go on to Amazon and look at reviews of products of these, you can see that people have issues with them. And again, if it's harder water and stuff, the heating element can fail very quickly in these units. We use a sheathed element, which was typically what you think of when you think of a hot water heating element. We use an Incoloy 800 material, which is a type of stainless steel, generally used on heating elements. And it was actually developed for pipes and nuclear reactors for very high temperature corrosion resistance. So the elements are gonna last much longer because the part that's doing the work is not exposed to the water flow past it. Another application where we can help with this is emergency showers. So OSHA requirements, when you pull the handle on an emergency shower after you get sprayed with chemicals, you must have tepid water, which is defined as anything below 90 degrees. So we selected 85, we can also do 75. And the shower has to provide 20 gallons per minute of flow at 30 PSI for 15 minutes. That's 300 gallons of water. And eyewash and eyeface wash have their requirements as well. So the letter of the law also says that multiple fixtures must meet flow requirements for simultaneous use. So if you have two showers, the showers have to be able to run at the same time. Now, this is quite a requirement. It's quite a bit of hot water, and a lot of times the building's hot water system, it's like an office building or an industrial complex or something like that, has to be designed around the emergency shower in order to meet these sort of requirements. So the solution that we've come up with, we have two different ones. One is the EMV, and it utilizes a 119-gallon tank, and by storing the water at 170 degrees, we can meet the requirements for a shower. So, one option is to put a 300-gallon tank and store at 85 degrees, which is not a good option. That's what people do occasionally. But, of course, you have a Legionnaire issue at that point. So by storing at the higher temperatures, we ensure there's no Legionnaire buildup. And the mixing valve that's included on these units has to be a special one because you don't want to scald people with 170-degree water. So there's three fail-safe mechanisms on it. There's actually two thermostatic portions of the valve to bring it down from 170 to the 85 degrees or 75 degrees that's required for these showers. And that's a key portion to our overall system of providing. Now, we also have an ETX unit, and we can handle various sizes of these. There's a mixing valve that's included in this unit. And they're ideal because, you don't have to store water. They're compact. They can be mounted right next to the shower. The downside is they require a lot of power, okay? So we make them up to 162 kW. Depending on what the delta T that's required for your shower, they're usually about 110 to 120 kW to run a single shower at 20 GPM. So they have to be quite large. That's the downside. Now, in industrial complexes, they may have the power, and since they don't run very often, it's not like they need to have that power continuously. So that's where we generally see those go in, but it's another unit that we have that ensures you can get the tepid water out for the emergency showers. Another thing that we do is we have a whole line of tanks with heat exchangers on them for tapping off the boilers. I guess you guys in California aren't gonna be seeing a whole lot more of these, but there's still gonna be some applications. So essentially these units use a plate and frame heat exchanger. And what the plate and frame heat exchanger allows us to do is to condense. And that's quite different from the older tube bundles where you could not condense in your boiler. So now by using these plate and frames, we're going to be just as efficient as a direct fire gas water heater for your hot water system. And in fact, it eliminates the separate stacks and intakes for your water heater. You just tack it onto your boiler. And the boiler only needs to be upsized for half of the hot water load in the building. So this is a less expensive, bit easier option than the direct fire gas water heaters. And so long as that heat exchanger is designed correctly, it's going to provide the condensing the same efficiency that you're going to get out of that. And I'll kind of leave you guys with this slide here. These are a couple different custom skids that we made. The one on the left is designed to do multiple zones, multiple pressure zones in the building. The one on the right, I don't know a whole lot about that one, but it's an explosion resistant. So kind of whatever can be dreamed up with water heaters, we can handle, we can do. And if you want the whole package or whatever, we can provide that for you as well. So, any questions that you guys have, let John know and he can get in touch with us and we can build very specific skids and very specific heaters for very specific applications. We have a lot of tools at our disposal to do this. One thing I'll mention is that we're working on it now, a full line of commercial heat pump water heaters that we have as well. Both air source and water source, and I know that's a big thing out in your market. And we'll be able to give a presentation on those soon. And we're doing things a little bit differently with them to ensure that we get the longest life and best performance out of these systems. So I guess in conclusion, if you have any questions about water heating, let us know. We can help out, answer them for you, and I'll answer any questions that anyone has.
Thank you, Brian. There was a question that Brent had, and that was a discussion regarding epoxy line tanks and how do they compare?
Mm-hmm. So epoxy line tanks are very similar to glass line tanks. They're still going to have an anode rod in them. They're still going to need that. And again, it has to do with the application of the epoxy on the inside of the tank not covering all the surfaces. So they're very similar to glass line tanks in terms of their longevity and performance and stuff.
All right, I'm going to start unmuting people. If other people have any other questions, feel free to discuss it. Do you have anything? Well, I'm going to turn off the recording. How about that? Okay, stop.